Good afternoon. It is 2:50, Wednesday, February 19th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, your weekly delivery man of sunshine and rainbows.
Can't top that. I'm just poor old Bill Finley.
John Green, DJ Sable general manager, and glad to be back after a one-week hiatus.
Brian DiNato, racing editor at the TDN and managing partner of Franklin Ave Equine.
Did you fly private to get back here? That's the question.
No, I did. I actually flew commercial, and last time I said I flew, and boy, are my arms tired, so I can't use that lame joke again. I have to wait another cycle before I can use that one.
All right. No, I don't think it'll stop you, but we'll go with that. The TDN Writers Room is sponsored by Keeneland, the home of world-class racing and industry-leading sales. Keeneland's next auction is the April 2-Year-Olds in Training and Horses of Racing Age sale on Tuesday, April 7th. So it was a good weekend, yet again, for Keeneland graduates. You had Mr. Monomoy and the Risen Star. Can we say, I hope Keeneland is as annoyed as I am that he's not Monomoy Boy. Because I feel like that's a little more symmetry. Monomoy Girl name, and Monomoy Boy. It's okay, fine. Mr. Monomoy. They also had Silver Prospector, who we didn't talk about, in the Southwest, who got a pretty good trip, but got a really good figure, too, a 97. Interestingly enough, in that race, the first two finishers, Silver Prospector and Wells Bayou, were both from the same consigner, which is Warrendale Sales. Shout out to them. You don't see that too often. And then you had Hard Not to Love in the Santa Monica. You had Factor This in the Fairground Stakes. Laura's Light in the Sweet Life. One other interesting Keeneland grad over the weekend that didn't win a stake but probably has a stakes in his future is Charlatan, who was made a TDN Rising Star, son of Spitestown, who was a $700,000 Keeneland September graduate, won off for Bob Baffert on Sunday at Santa Anita and got a 105 buyer. What did you guys think of that?
Remains to be seen, but obviously the comparisons to Justify are going to come up, and he's got a long way to go to be another Justify. But Charlatan got a 105 buyer in his first start. Justify got a 104. Charlatan won by 5 3/4 lengths. Justify won by 9.5. I don't think that's all that relevant. Be interesting to see what Baffert does with this horse next, because obviously now everybody's going to be clamoring for this horse to get into the Derby. He ran Justify in his second career start in an allowance race in the San Anita Derby. Again, he's not telling the press anything about what he's going to do with any of his good horses right now, which is, his right to do, I suppose. But I did notice there was an allowance race in the book at Santa Anita that he'd be eligible for on March 14th. But then could he come back after that and go to the Santa Anita Derby? Baffert's got a lot of planning to do. He's got at least 4 very good three-year-olds. He's going to use the Arkansas route. Certainly he's going to use the California route. But I'm sure he wants to, separate them and not have them run against one another. So he's got to get a little creative here.
And aside from the ones that you guys have mentioned, you know, you talk about Keeneland being a great sale for the November sale, a great, buyer sale for the September sale. But Mucho Gusto, who won the Grade 1 Pegasus, sold for $95,000. Hard Not to Love.
We talked about him last week, John. You weren't here. We talked about
him. I know. I heard. Okay. It's okay. It's called all overlapping.
Right. Gotcha. Gotcha.
Mr. Monomoy, who we talked about. Nadal, who sold for $65,000, and is also on the list. Mischievic Alex, Tonal Lachere, Authentic. These are all horses that were purchased, for relatively reasonable amounts at the Keeneland sale. And I can tell you, as a buyer, I enjoy going to Keeneland. You're surrounded by excitement and possibilities and the magic of the future. And it's almost like going to Disney World for me. I mean, you really, you walk in, you see the same cast of characters that you do at Disney. You walk into Main Street USA and you can buy your hat. You go to Keeneland, you get your seats. Adventureland at Disney, has all the great rides. Adventureland to me is like walking around the sales, grounds and going to all the barns and everything like that. And then Fantasyland, to me is what the horses are going to project and what they're going to look like, in your silk. So to me, it's like going to Disney World, and you get to do that not once, not twice, but half a dozen times, during the course of the year. I think the only thing that Disney doesn't have that Keeneland does have is something that I dub as Regretville, which is usually when I look at the results and say, oh, I should have been on that horse and I should have, maybe I should go back and look at that one. How could I have sold that horse for that? So Regretville is usually, population of 2. It's usually me and Bill's stylist. We pretty much, live in Regretville. But otherwise, Keeneland Disney World to me is like one and the same.
Do they have Space Mountain? That's the most important thing.
You know, you feel like you're on a ride. If you bid on a horse, all kidding aside, the horse is only in there for 30 to 60 seconds. Yeah. And Brian, you know, you probably agree with me on this, but your heart is pounding, you're sweating, and you get your adrenaline going.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And that's if you're even in, you know, just watching the horse come in. If you're actually bidding mano a mano, then all of a sudden it's just this whole range of emotions that go on. So that's kind of like Space Mountain.
All right, so I don't even know where to begin with this story. I feel like this kind of is emblematic of all the issues in racing when it comes to transparency and drugs and everything really wrapped into one. It's a nice little mélange of all the issues confronting racing right now. Basically, all you need to know is Joe Sharp had a bunch of horses test positive for levamisole. Am I pronouncing that correctly? And 8 of them got DQ'd. And then over the weekend, it was reported on Sunday, which is the main problem, that two horses who ran on Saturday at Fairgrounds, one of whom who won the Grade 3 Mineshaft, had tested positive for the same drug in their previous races. And they were allowed to run on Saturday. And like I said, one of them won. And it's not as if the Fairgrounds racing office and the powers that be at Fairgrounds didn't know this, because on Saturday, they adjusted the weight of Silver Dust. Silver Dust is the horse in question who won the Mineshaft. They adjusted his weight because of the conditions of the race, down from 122 to 118, because technically he hadn't won his previous race, the Louisiana Stakes, even though he actually had. And then after they let him run and win the race, the next day, Fairgrounds comes out and there's a report in Daily Racing Form that this horse had tested positive for this drug in his previous race. So I'm going to, like, I need a moment to gather my thoughts on this thing. So I'm going to, like, open it up to the room. But just the idea that this horse was allowed to run, the bettors had no idea that he tested positive for a drug in his previous race, allowed to run, allowed to win, and that this was kept from the public and from the betting public, to me is just absolutely inexcusable. And I'm sure you guys feel similarly.
You're going to be surprised. I don't have a whole lot to say about this. But number one, transparency. Transparency, transparency, transparency. We've been sitting here for 6-7 months, and this subject seems to come up on every single podcast. And I think if we're sitting here 7 years from now, it's going to come up on podcasts, because racing just doesn't do the right thing by this. Now, this was a mess. I don't know who you point the finger of blame at, but there is an easy solution to this. The horses had to run as non-betting interest. Then nobody gets the shaft there, and the owner gets to run the horse. I mean, I don't know how serious this thing against Joe Sharp is. I don't think it's a whole big deal, so I don't think he necessarily deserved to be penalized. But, you know, weight matters. The right information matters, et cetera. In doubt, when in doubt, just run as non-betting interest, and then, you know, pretty much everybody's happy.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it's also, from my understanding, it's kind of a family affair, because isn't Joe Sharp and Brett Calhoun by marriage – related?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And their barns, according to Marcus Hirsch, are right next to each other.
Right next to each other. So, you know, so is there smoke? Is there fire? I'm not really sure about that. But at some point in time, I didn't even realize about the weight change before the race. So obviously, you know, more importantly, they knew something was.
And I don't think there was any explanation. It was
nope.
It
was just
-4.
-4. And usually it's the overweight. Right. Usually it's okay. So and so is 2 pounds overweight. So, you know, it's shocking that it was changed by the clerk of scales, an official. And it wasn't, there was never an explanation or anything like that. It's out of all the stories and the negativity we've talked about, save, you know, horses dying, because that's the ultimate worst thing. This has got to be one of the biggest black eyes that's out there.
I'm with you. And the other horse that we didn't mention, it was DQ'd. It's Blackberry Wine that was the other horse. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he was coming, ran a huge race the day he was DQ'd, earned a 94 buyer, was 4-1 in one of the divisions of the Risen Star. Obviously, he took a lot of money based on that race, which is kind of appalling when you think about it. I think one thing that I kind of mentioned to Joe, I don't know if this is a controversial take. I'll be interested to see what other people think. I don't think horses who get DQ'd, and it really doesn't apply in this instance, but it does on another couple of horses that ran this weekend. I don't think horses who get DQ'd should keep that condition. A perfect example is Saturday at Oaklawn, one of Joe Sharp's horses who was DQ'd. Sycamore Run, he romped first out. I think he was DQ'd from that start later on. Came back in the maiden special weight at Oaklawn after having already run in the LeCompte and was 3-5, kind of made the race unappealing from a betting standpoint. And, you know, he got DQ'd from a $45,000 race, so he could win an $85,000 race.
Oh, my God.
That's terrible.
Yeah. So there's, I think there's two possible remedies to that. One is what you're saying is that the horses don't get their condition back, which I think makes sense. The other one, I think, is you put the horse on the sidelines for 60 days and you don't let the horse run back until this whole thing is adjudicated. Because to me, that gets through to the owner. If the owners who pay the trainers' bills start not being able to run their horses because of test positives, then maybe you'll see owners start to take horses away from trainers who test positive. Because really, right now, what is the consequence if you are a trainer and have a horse who tests positive for a drug? You run your horse, even if you get suspended, which neither of these guys got suspended. Even if you get suspended, you run your horse in your assistant's name. Business goes on as usual. You still collect the checks. Nothing changes, really, unless you get popped for a long suspension, which doesn't happen until you get, like, what, 5 or 6, you know, drug positives. To me, there have to be stronger consequences. And this thing, I don't know, I really have no interest in talking about how powerful this drug is. The ARCI has it as a class 2 drug. I really have no business talking about that. And I honestly don't have any interest in talking about Joe Sharp or Brett Calhoun or their practices, because that's not my issue. My issue here is how racing makes itself look like Mickey Mouse, Bush League garbage with stuff like this. And just imagine this. Imagine if there were any other sport and this happened. Like imagine the NFL. And after the day after the Super Bowl, the NFL came out and said, oh yeah, by the way, a bunch of Chiefs tested positive for steroids in the conference championship game, and we'll punish them. We'll fine them later on. But the Super Bowl was clean. Don't worry about it. Trust us. Imagine that happening. Or imagine.
Well, it did. It did in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, right. Exactly what you're doing with the Houston Astros.
Right.
You know, players, never mind, you know, go on about your business and, you know, polish those World Series rings. But Joe, it's interesting because you brought up something that is more than just your theory. It wasn't widely reported, but the positives for this drug have popped up in a bunch of different places, among them New Mexico. And exactly what you just advocated for is the rule in New Mexico. And I don't know the name of the trainer, the circumstance or anything, but I did see somewhere that whomever got the levamisole positive in New Mexico, that's exactly what they did. They gave the horse 60 days it can't run. I mean, we really got to the point where the voice of reason in horse racing is the New Mexico Racing Commission. Well, in this case, yes.
Well, and you haven't called for them to close, like Rockingham or, you know, or any other
race. Oh, get him
started
at Mountaineer Park, you know.
Exactly. But how would you like to be sitting there now and you guys are, you know, Whisper Hill and Three Chimneys Farm, and you paid $2.6 million for Gunnett. And you said, I'm just going to go ahead to 30-1 and run the horse. And now all of a sudden, you know, you run second, which is very respectable in a grade three. And now all of a sudden you're a grade three winner by default. And I guess you can make the argument, hey, maybe Silver Dust shouldn't have won because of the additional drug and et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is they didn't play by the rules. They didn't play by the rules that are set out. And I think it just adds additional credibility and credence to the idea of having centralized rules. And more importantly, this idea of, you know, from Hong Kong, of a centralized pharmacy where it doesn't matter what drugs the trainers want to, you know, have their horses run on. It has to run through the centralized pharmacy. And if they're not going to supply it, then the horse isn't going to get it. And then it really comes down to actual true horsemanship.
And just to go back to that baseball reference, because baseball is dealing with a cheating scandal, I think it would be even worse because it would be like if the Astros won the 2017 title and then came back and won in 2018. And then the day after the 2018 title, the MLB was like, oh, we just found out they were cheating to win the 2017 title. But don't worry, the 2018 title is clean. Nothing to see here. That's what racing is. That's what Fairgrounds has done here. And listen, I have no problem with Fairgrounds. Honestly, I like betting their races. I've bet them a lot in the past. I think it's pretty good quality racing, but what a joke. Could you spit in the face any more of your fans and your bettors to have this be the way you treat them? That there's a horse who won a graded stake on Saturday and was DQ'd, and we didn't know about it until after he won the graded stake. What are we doing?
Right, and they knew ahead of time, which you know, it's because of the weight change. So here's my question, because I just literally personally over the weekend dove into the foray of the pick and pray handicapping contest. Let's say that I had Gunnett down and, you know, Gunnett finished second. I would have gotten 1740 towards my pool. Okay. Now the contest is over. 2 days later, they come out and say, well, we're DQing Silver Dust. Do they retroactively go back and change it? Because if so, I get a seat, you know, in Vegas, or whoever finished second, you know, in essence. Unfortunately, I didn't finish second. But if whoever finished second, that's going to push them over the top because the horse is 30-1.
Yeah.
If it was like an 8-5 and a 7-5, well, then it's not really going to move the needle. But there's going to be a lot of people, I think, if they recognize this and they sit down and say, I had Gunnett in this stake race, and all the people who won on Silver Dust now get DQ'd, they lose it. And that's a huge move. That's a big dollar change. In such a, you know, in a contest like that.
But John, you can't do that retroactively. I mean, a guy comes, the race is declared official. The guy walks up to the cashier's window and gets a 1740 case closed. I mean,
right. You
know, that just would create
I understand it's exactly a what you're box. Saying,
but, yeah, but it would, you know, open up a can of worms. It just, yeah. You could never get the worms back into the can. It would just be, you know, just too unmanageable. Right. Everything you said makes sense from that standpoint. But, you know, the cardinal rule of horse racing is no matter what, when the judges make the race official, that's the result so far as betting goes. Not the result so far as what, you know, the ultimate outcome with positives and that sort of thing. But as far as the bettors are concerned, I mean, anybody bet on Dancer's Image in the Kentucky Derby, they didn't have to get
good
the
point.
Money back.
Good point.
So,
yep. You know.
I think we should clarify that he got DQ'd for the race two back. So Blended Citizen was second. But it's we talk about this a lot, and I've said it a bunch. It's hard to want to bet horses with stuff like this. It's just reason number 1,000 why, you know, how do you bet a horse race and then look back and see this? And I actually had an interesting kind of anecdotal related thing on Monday. We ran a horse at Aqueduct. We made a late jockey change to an apprentice, and they wouldn't let us take the 5-pound allowance because he was listed as, you know, the other rider was going to carry the full weight. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great rule. And that's, you know, that's a good example of a rule that does protect the bettors to an extent. I mean, I don't know if the 5 pounds made a difference. We would have taken 50 off. It might have helped more. But, but yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing is that the bettor has to be protected because I think they have the least say in anything. And I think, I mean, they're the customers.
And honestly, like I said, I don't have anything against Fairgrounds beyond this and beyond the takeout because – Why would I bet a Fairgrounds race right now? After this happens, the pick fours are 24-25%. The pick five is the stupid jackpot wager. I would love to support them. I like John Dooley. I like the long stretch. They have big fields. They have a decent turf course. But if you're going to slap me in the face as a bettor, why am I going to go bet your product? And this happened to me last year, too. And I don't bet Oaklawn anymore because of it. I had a pick five and I got 4 out of 5. And the horse that I singled in the race I didn't hit ran second. And the ticket paid $24,000. And there was a headline in the, I guess maybe it was Pollock Report or something, a day or two later, that the horse who actually won that race, turns out he was ineligible to run under the conditions of the race. And it cost me $25,000. Why would I ever go back and bet this track? So, I mean, they're dropping like flies for me.
I was going to say, what else are you betting on? Where else can you bet?
I mean, I bet Gulfstream, but I guarantee I could find a couple problems with their product, too. But, listen, I'm not a whale by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm not a minnow either. You know, I bet a good amount. And I'm not the only one who is going to be vastly offended by this, by Fairgrounds' chicanery, and is not going to want to put any more money through the windows at their track. So this kind of short-sightedness where it seems to me like the main goal is to protect the trainers and to protect the owners and to make sure that the punishments are as small as possible and the bettors be damned, that stuff has got to stop if racing is ever going to grow or at the very least stop its rapid decline.
I'll be honest, I think it's more incompetence than anything in most cases and most things like this in life. Yeah, that was my main point.
No, I mean, yeah.
Right? I don't think they're like, we've got to protect Brett Calhoun or whatever.
No, but I think their priorities are such that the bettors are at the very bottom
I agree with that
of
completely.
Who they are accountable to.
Right.
Joe, if you had won that pick five, then you probably would have won enough money. You wouldn't be here right now. So
I would have been on the private jet with
exactly.
you.
Exactly. So yeah. The main thing is the podcast audience is benefiting from your loss. Yes. And I want to say it was your loss because you actually didn't cash that ticket.
Thanks,
you
Jeff.
Lost. It wasn't even consolation. Okay. Yeah,
he would have given it all back on a 25% takeout.
That's right.
The rest of us suckers.
Yep. Oh, yeah. So you can thank Oakland Park for the fact that I'm sitting here with you guys right now instead of on a beach somewhere. No, but it's... Yeah, I think Brian, the point is right that it is incompetence, but in the end, like the result is the same,
right.
Whether or not you don't want to say malicious intent, but in the end, like they don't care. These tracks do not care about the bettors, and then they throw their hands up in the air and they cry and they wonder why no one wants to bet their product and why handle's going down. It's because of crap like this. It's hard enough to bet horses and make money betting horses as it is when you throw in garbage like this that would not be accepted in any other sport in the world, then you have your answer why people don't want to give you money and bet your product.
I think another interesting topic is we're talking about scandals in other sports. Obviously, the big difference in racing is that the tracks are taking bets, but now that sports betting is more prevalent, I wonder if kind of there's more similarity there now than ever. And yeah, obviously, the NFL has been, you know, betting's kind of moved the needle for them for many years, even if it's kind of unsaid. But I feel like it's kind of different now with sports betting being out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to have to be more accountability, but I think the other leagues do a good job because they have acknowledged for a long time that people have vested interest in these games, and racing, which is a baseline gambling endeavor, still doesn't seem to care about that. So that's a great way to run your business. We really appreciate it here. So we will talk about what happened on the track at Fairgrounds on Saturday, although who knows if any of the results will stand. Maybe we'll get a fun little alert in a month from now that none of those results mattered because they were failed drug tests. Anyway, you did have a couple of good performances in the Risen Star. I think Mr. Monomoy especially was pretty impressive to keep taking heat and keep on going. And I think he got a 92 buyer. The other half of the race got an 84 with Modernist, who had a similar trip. I think Mr. Monomoy is a little bit interesting. I heard Brad Cox kind of questioning how far he thinks the horse wants to go. But once you go on a mile and an eighth, it really isn't that much more of a stretch to go a mile and a quarter in the Derby. So what did you guys think of the three-year-old races on Saturday?
I thought they were good performances. You have some very interesting angles here. First of all, Mr. Monomoy, obviously the fact that he's a half to Monomoy girl, and they got him for a steal. Was it 60,000?
60,000 is Greenland.
He sold again at a 2-year-old training sale in Europe for, I think it was like 200,000 euros
even that,
or something.
Even that is obviously not a big price. And now Modernist is Bill Mott trying to win the Kentucky Derby without the asterisk next to it, you know, getting put up. But these prep races, I would say the same thing about the Southwest this weekend. I personally had a hard time getting that interested in them because really you go down the list of everybody's top 10, top 12, T.D. Thornton's, et cetera. Really, you know, who among the marquee horses was really in these races. And so, you know, I think there's some question of who did they beat? But this, I think, is going to be an ongoing story, not just this year, but years to come, because now it's gotten to the point where, you know, every horse is taking 2 months off in between races. Nobody's going to have more than two preps for the Derby. You know, the day and age when we'd see somebody go, you know, January, February, March, April, 1 month apart and running all these races, that's long gone. So you got 8,000 Derby preps out there, you know, some of them with huge amounts of money. Based on, you know, the tis the laws of the world, you know, running every so often, a lot of these races, I think, are going to come up fairly weak.
No question about it. And if you look at the point values for a lot of these preps, really, they don't really start. I mean, they don't make any great impact until the next ones, until the ones starting, you know, February 29th and going forward. Again, I talked about a couple of podcasts ago that you really need 40 baseline points in order to be, you know, one of the starters for the Derby. So all of these other races are just kind of cannon fodder to get them up to the point until they start running in March or April. Flipping back to the actual races themselves, I thought it was interesting that not only was there such a disparity in the buyer number between the two winners, but obviously in the time, it was almost a, you know, 4/5 of a second difference. The winner of the 13th race, Modernist, would have been 5th in the 12th race, which was the first part of the Risen Star. And we wouldn't necessarily even be talking about this Bill Mott horse, except that he won the quote-unquote easier split of the race.
And I think what's interesting, I think they had this exact same half-mile split and both horses were kind of sitting in the same spot. So, I mean, Mr. Monomoy obviously came home a lot quicker.
Mr. Monomoy, Enforceable, Silver State, right. Farmington Road, they all came back. You know, yeah. They all came down faster. You're exactly right. 24-1 versus 24-1, 48-2 for both halves, 12-3 versus 12-4, and then, you know, the top four horses in the first part of the race, you know, moved forward. So it's going to be interesting once they start getting these, you know, winnowing down and getting these horses into some of the bigger races. But Bill, to your point, none of these really mean anything at this stage of the game. I mean, it's great money for the owners and the trainers. But otherwise, you know, you get your 15 minutes of fame and the big boy races start, you know, in about a week and a half.
This week's news is sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership is one of the most affordable, smart, and fun ways for new owners to enjoy all the fun of being an insider in an entirely new world for a fraction of the cost. Check them out at westpointtb.com. And there was some big news for West Point this week. They had Hard Not to Love, who won impressively in the Santa Monica Stakes on Saturday at Santa Anita. And she's a really cool horse. I like horses like this who are very versatile. She won her debut, I believe, going wire to wire. Then she closed from last to win the La Brea, and she's won Stalking as well. Another interesting thing about her is she got one eye. She's following in the footsteps of Patch and Pollard's Vision. Maybe Pollard's Vision didn't have one eye, but he was definitely blind in one eye, so it's close enough. So she's a really cool horse. What do you guys think?
Well, it looks like she's going to become a fan favorite, not only because of the one-eye thing, but she's a very good racehorse. So congratulations to West Point. Terry Finley, the managing partner of West Point, tells me that they're going to go in the Beholder Mile with her next. And the significance of that is that all her wins have come around one turn. She's never tried two turns. So if she wins that race, it opens up a whole new world for her. And then you could see her being, you know, Breeders' Cup Distaff type horse if she wins that. If she doesn't, she could be a Breeders' Cup Filly Mare Sprint horse. I think the sky's the limit for her. No matter what.
I'm with you. I think she might be the best older mare out there right now, and I don't see why distance would be any issue for her. She's got a big pedigree by Hardspun and from that Wonder Godot family. So, yeah, I think sky's the limit for sure.
And just talk about pedigree, to piggyback on that, you know, Hardspun was basically one of those stallions that people were writing off. And then in the past year and a half, he's just exploded with all these great horses. So it's really nice to see when good horses kind of, you know, become more relevant and start having a lot of progeny that are fulfilling their dreams. We do a lot with Darley and Kate Galvin specifically there, and they're just wonderful people to work with. So it's great to see that a Hardspun is another Hardspun, I should say, is really dominating in her field.
And West Point will be going for back-to-back weekends of stakes victories at Santa Anita. They have Caressa is being pointed for the Buena Vista Stakes on this Saturday. She's coming off a win in her turf debut in the Megahertz, so 1-for-1 on the turf. So how good is she? Is she a turf monster now? We'll find out. So good luck to West Point with Caressa this weekend.
So I wanted to segue because there was a nice three-year-old filly performance on Saturday at Fairgrounds and Finite. Race which in the Rachel Alexandra race, which featured the return of champion 2-year-old filly British Idiom, and Finite beat her pretty much fair and square. British Idiom had a little bit of a wide trip, but Finite really kind of blew the doors off her. Frankly, I thought it was going to be a much closer race than that. And that segues into today. We are running our first TDN Kentucky Oaks top 10. We've been doing the Derby top 12 for a while now, and this year we have just started with the top 10. Bill Finley is writing that column. Bill, what did you think about the way Rachel Alexandra?
Well, first of all, I thought it was a much more interesting and better race than the Risen Star, because you did have two very good horses that would have been in anybody's top five coming into it in Finite and British Idiom. And I made, and you'll see it in the TDN when it comes out, in the first ever, drumroll please, TDN Road to the Kentucky Oaks, Finite number one. And I think it's pretty much a no-brainer, to be honest with you. And as I was telling you guys before we started the podcast, when I do these top 10 things, I try to not be a wise guy. I don't come up, you know, some turf horse that I think has a dirt pedigree that just ran a sneaky third in an allowance race somewhere. The champion came out in British Idiom, and Finite beat her fair and square and beat her decisively. Now, you can make some argument for British Idiom. She did have a wide trip, and it was her first start off a long layoff where Finite's been running all along, but not enough to say that, you know, she was so good that you could see her beating Finite next time out. I think Finite proved on that day she's the better of the two horses. Now, that obviously could change down the road, but if she's better than the 2-year-old champion, then why wouldn't she be the number one horse? I mean, there's some really good horses, and of course, you know, we lost this week tragically. The horse that might have been the best three-year-old filly of them all, and Taraz, also trained by Brad Cox. So that was a real blow for everybody involved. But yeah, Finite to me proved herself, and Steve Asmussen looks like he's got a very nice filly on the road to Kentucky Oaks.
So Bill, let me just throw a couple out there at you, because we actually ran against Harvey's Little Goyle. What was your thought on that American Pharoah filly?
Definitely, you know, looks like she's pretty good. I think I had her ninth or something in my top 10.
Oh, Bill, come on.
Really?
Ninth, really?
Well, all she did was win the freaking
Busanda. Did you watch the replay?
She won the Busanda. What's the Busanda?
Yeah, but the Busanda is nine furlongs.
It's in the middle of it. The aqueduct in the winter was 16 come people on. In the stands. You know, it's the Busanda. No, I'm not going to get excited about a horse that won the freaking Busanda. You know, you start running against some big girls in the big girl races. By the way, Mott said that she's probably going to run next. He must love New York and aqueduct. The Gazelle is probably next for her. So
how many people are going to be in the stands that day?
They'll be 18.
Yes.
That's the over-under, right? Yeah. Exactly.
You went in the winter at Aqueduct. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you win my 50 likes. I got to see something more.
All right, one more. How about Tonal Shape?
I put her 10th.
Wait, who's Raider? Who's Crowder? Who is two through
Bill
eight here?
I'm with Bill on this one. She ran a 70
buyer. Ruffy and Rachel Alexandra. Yeah, she went. I had her a little bit higher, and I kept looking at that 70 buyer in last start. And she's going to be, because of that 70 buyer, she's going to be 8-1 on the Forward Gal. Not the Forward Gal, the Devona Dale when it comes around. And I know Safi Joseph wins like 92% of his starts with everything. But no, she's very good. But, you know, man, tough crowd here.
Tough crowd. How about you're putting 9th and 10th, these great fillies?
Who's second? Okay. I need to see the whole
list. Yeah, I mean, Venetian Harbor, we can talk about
okay.
her.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, what, you know, Bill is a master at a lot of things, and marketing is one of them, because he's like slowly saying, okay, 9th, 10th, and we're all like on the edge of our seat. Yeah. Who are 2 through 7? You know, I mean, what a master marketer.
You'll have to download
it. Now I don't have the damn thing. All right.
I set it up, so I feel like I might even remember better than Bill.
Okay, so I know my top two were Finite and Venetian Harbor.
Three was British Idiom.
British Idiom. I don't know any. Yeah, I'm so shell shocked now. I don't know. But okay, you want to tell me that and Harvey's Little Goyle is half owned by a friend of mine, Paul Bramer, so I better be nice. But you really want to tell me that those two horses deserve to be above the horses I just mentioned?
No, they shouldn't be 1, 2, or 3, but I was surprised that you said 9th or 10th. So where's Bast? Is she even on
the list?
She's
4th.
She's 4th, right. And by the way, she's not going. I should have just dropped her out.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Baffert's now like Mr. Secretive. He won't tell anybody anything. The horses, Bast is, I had to take it on face value, so she's 4th. Okay. Adana Veloce is probably 5th, something like that. And then, you know,
Wicked Whisper.
Wicked Whisper, Lake Avenue. 7 Lake Avenue. And
a lot of fast, two-year-olds.
He's like Rain Man.
Then the two best fillies, someone else, and then the two best fillies that ever lived, Wicked Whisper and Tonal Shape. But Baffert's been strange. The guy who's like, you know, the most happy-go-lucky guy and so good with the press now won't tell anybody anything. And
he won't tell anybody anything, or he won't tell you anything?
No, he won't tell. No, look at the Santa Anita. No, oh, my God, man, more of this. No, the Santa Anita notes this week, basically, where are all your colts running? None of your business, get lost, which is pretty much in notes this week.
Cranky.
But Bass, who has not worked since January 18th, I almost didn't put her in there whatsoever. If she doesn't have a workout by the time I do this next time, I will drop her out.
Can we give Bill some Levamisil? Try to even him out a little bit?
Yeah.
Hopefully it doesn't metabolize into whatever that other drug is.
But, you know, now since Wicked Whisper is definitely it's not Wicked Whisper. Which was the one you guys are going crazy over? Harvey's Little Goyle. So she's going to win the Kentucky Oaks by 25
lines. No, she's going to win the Gazelle at least.
Yeah. Well, again, you know.
I just think a lot of the horses
at least that's a graded race. I mean.
I wonder about a lot of the horses up there going 9 furlongs. She's at least one that's kind of proven.
Right. And so was the other Mott horse, Lake Avenue.
Right,
so,
right. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So now I have one, maybe two running the Devona Dale. If that filly is 8-1, then who do you think is going to be the favorite for the Devona Dale? It may not be a fair answer.
I know the other one is that Pletcher thing that won by a million lengths.
Spice is nice, or whatever.
Spice is nice, exactly.
I think she'll probably be, well, I don't know.
Yeah, she might be the favorite in that.
Yeah. I mean, this day and age, you know, it's no big deal to go from a maiden win right into a great stake.
She didn't get a big figure, though, did she? I don't know. A huge figure.
I think she got something in the 80s, I think.
Yeah.
Well, she wasn't a TDN Rising Star, so if she doesn't make that.
She was.
Oh, okay, good. Star, I was going to say, if she doesn't make that, then no wonder that
don't
she's
start
not
on that
list.
Train. Right? You'll be calling us at 5 o'clock on a Saturday asking for Rising Stars.
Oh, man. I just give you exclusives. I don't ask for favors.
Yeah, thanks for the tip on Super Ego, by the way. sorry. John told me about this horse that they have super ego. First time out of Aqueduct, he was like, this thing is great. He's outworking all these horses. So I bet the thing, and it sort of runs like six.
Oh, that's the horse that won.
And then the other day, he texted me. He goes, super ego won the other day. 12-1 thanks, bro.
You didn't get the text. He texted me. So like,
beforehand. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, my. All right. I'm out of here. You guys can host yourself. One interesting little sidebar, you mentioned Saffy Joseph. I think it's an interesting thing when a guy dominates so much at one track, and then you have to see if he can replicate that success elsewhere. And he really hasn't shipped a lot of horses a lot of places since he started winning everything at Gulfstream. He shipped two over the weekend that I saw. Maybe there was another one. He had Math Wizard, who was pretty bad in the Razorback, ran eighth. And then he had NY Traffic, who I thought ran okay in the second division of the Risen Star, was up on the pace. I think ran fourth or fifth. So
I thought it was maybe third.
Okay. So that horse ran pretty well. So I think that's an interesting thing to look at going forward, is whether or not he can replicate this pretty unprecedented level of success elsewhere when he ships out of Gulfstream. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With more than 500 clients in the horse business, they were bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the CEO of Woodbine, Jim Lawson. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Great to be on. Thanks, Joe.
Yeah. So I'm going to start with a little bit of a general question. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on is I think Woodbine has done a good job in terms of introducing new ideas and new wrinkles and new developments into racing, and it's a sport that really badly needs that kind of thing. I think back to when you guys started running the races clockwise, which was an interesting wrinkle for me, and I had never really seen that outside of European racing. What are some of the innovations that you guys have brought in at Woodbine that you're most proud of? And can you speak to the importance of always needing to try new things?
Well, sure. I think that it's no secret that I think racing across North America is in a very competitive market, particularly in the entertainment and sports area. And of course, sports betting now. And I think in certainly the mindset of our board and our management team is really, we need to try new things. And the clockwise racing was the start of that. And that, I think, set the tone that we're willing to try new things. And of course, the importance of doing it is we all recognize, in addition to the competitive nature that we're working in this industry, we also have a new demographic to fan. And so I think there are a lot of things that we need to take a hard look at on how we're doing things. And Woodbine has a culture right now of we're hoping and thinking that we're leaders in a number of areas. And I think one of the things that I'm most proud of is a heavy investment in innovation and technology. We have an innovation department, a technology department that numbers approximately 25 people. And they are constantly looking at new products. And you'll see this spring, Joe, that we're coming out with a branded product called Dark Horse, which will be a mobile app for Android and Apple users. And it will stream races live on mobile app, and it will have scheduled races. It will use artificial intelligence to determine outcomes. And our beta testing shows a very, very high percentage of win rates. And it's not only to put our customers on a level playing field, but it also simplifies things. So that new customer can come to the racetrack, and rather than trying to figure out the racing form, I appreciate the racing form has a lot of loyal customers, but the new generation, our testing shows that they love using the artificial intelligence to determine the outcome of a race, and it's been successful. So we will launch that, and we think it's going to be a big success, and we're looking to license it across North America. So that's a big proud step for us in terms of how we're looking at things. Our innovation group and wagering group have come up with crossbreed wagering. We have wagers between our harness racing track at Mohawk and Woodbine. We have cross country pick fours with other thoroughbred tracks. We have developed a product on the harness side with Meadowlands and Mohawk joint wagers. So there's a lot of things that we're trying on the technology and innovation side, and including 360 cameras and drones, and we've got a very skilled group there. So that's probably the biggest accomplishment in terms of trying new things in terms of our technology. That would be the biggest step, and I think you're going to see us being leaders in broadcasting and innovation and technology, and it's has in large part to do, Joe, with the fact that this young demographic, that's how they're going to consume horse racing and on their mobile phone, and in the end was really that's how they're going to wager too. We're moving to completely mobile. Our HPI system today is probably one of the most, I don't know if you've ever used it, but it's one of the most advanced ADW systems going, and that technology will be improved upon, in fact, in the dark horse technology that we're coming out with this spring.
Jim, it's Bill Finley. Thanks so much for joining us. And Ontario Racing has been on quite a roller coaster over the last few years. Things were going great. Then the government came in and took away all the slot money. Then things were horrible for a brief period of time. Then the government came back and said, okay, we understand the devastation we've done to this industry, and provided Ontario Racing with subsidies. First of a two-part question, I'm going to follow this up afterwards. Where do things now stand so far as the revenue you get from the government, and is there a time frame when that expires?
Well, things currently stand, I mean, you have to remember that in Ontario we have, I think, 15 racetracks, and that is varying levels of 13 of the 15 are harness racing tracks, and then there's Fort Erie and Woodbine. And each of them, to a greater extent than others, on what I'll call a government funding agreement, which is a 17-year agreement that starts next year with the government. So horse racing in Ontario is on very stable grounds, in particular at Woodbine and Mohawk, where we have the benefit of a long-term lease with the gaming operators at our two places. And it's not dependent on the slot machines. It's the fact that we have been able to secure long-term leases with the gaming operators, which directly ties into funding agreement. But the amount of commercial leasing money we get reduces our ability to receive government funding. So we will see the day in the next two or three years, I expect, where Woodbine is not on any form of government subsidy. And we'll stand completely on our own based on our commercial leases. And at the same time, we are hoping to increase our revenues, not only through majoring, and I think the Woodbine brand, as I just mentioned, our technology, we are hoping to grow our per mutual wagering. But as we've talked about a number of times, including with you, Bill, we're blessed to be sitting on 700 acres of land in probably the largest undeveloped tract of land in a city in North America. We're smack dab in the middle of the city now, and there are six cranes on the property today. There's an entertainment center going in, two hotels, gaming floor expansion. We are paying for a new train station to stop at Woodbine. And that will connect, ultimately, we will connect Woodbine to the Toronto Airport and to downtown. So it's very promising that we're not only on stable grounds for the next 20 years in terms of our purses, but there's growth coming in those purses and our business generally from the property development.
Jim, it's John Green from DJ Stable, and we had the pleasure of running a horse Proven Strategies this summer in the Summer Stakes. And one of the decisions that we made from a racing standpoint was in conversation with our trainer of that horse, Mark Cassie. And Mark said, I really want to run Proven Strategies up here in Canada. And I know it's kind of a schlep to get up here, but it's, you know, it's such a safe racetrack. Such as to train on such a beautiful turf course. And he was a big advocate, you know, on Woodbine, you know, both as a training facility, as well as a racing surface. It looks like that a lot of the safety items that you guys have, a protocol you guys have put into place with two turf courses and with the Tapeda synthetic track are now being copied or examined by other racetracks, so much so that Turfway just announced that they're going to implement the same synthetic track. You know, what do you think as far as the future of racing? Are more tracks going to be turf primarily and the synthetics, or are they going to be, you know, kind of behind the times and behind you guys as far as the safety initiatives?
Well, it's a good question. And I was interviewed the other day regarding Turfway and the move to Tapeda. And I think the first premise is that, you know, we all as an industry have to be more conscious of providing consistent and safe surfaces. And I think the starting point is that the reinvestment in the surfaces is so important to create consistent surfaces for the horses, whether they're dirt tracks or Tapeda tracks or turf courses. The horses need footing that can be consistent for them, and they won't take the bad steps. And if they don't take the bad steps, the risk of catastrophic injury goes down, and the statistics show that. I mean, there's so many races and so many starters in a year that the statistics don't lie, and you have to respect that. As to where racing's going, I think that we have now installed that new inner turf course, which you may have seen. And I expect that we are going to have the same results out of that turf course. Our turf numbers are very good already, but that course stays firm even when there's been torrential downpours. Even the day before, we can be yielding or off the turf on our EP Taylor course, and we will remain on the turf on that course. And for us, it's well cut. It's well drained. It's a lot of fiber and sand in it. And it, as a turf course, is a consistent surface. And that's the type of thing that, leaving aside the dirt Tapeda angle for a second or dirt and synthetic angle for a second, racetracks really need to look after their turf courses. And much easier. We are now looking at a reinvestment in our EP Taylor course. It's a beautiful course and has a good safety record, but now that we've seen what we can do with modern technology and modern drainage and growing techniques, we're excited about the prospect of grass racing on a very, very safe and consistent surface. And so I can see people looking at this Woodbine turf course now, the new turf course, and saying, wow, look at what can be done now. And on the Tapeda, again, I think I don't know that we're ahead of our time in the sense that pressures on the industry today in terms of catastrophic injuries. I think you may well see moves in California towards synthetic surfaces. There's no question, as I said, they're more consistent. Depends on the climate. They're easier to manage, but I think it's important to understand that even with the Tapeda surface, there's a lot of maintenance and work that goes to learning how to properly maintain Tapeda surfaces for safe footing for horses. So I think it's the way of the future. I'm not sure that some of the traditionalists will go that way, and that's fine. I'm not critical of that. I think it's just important that racetracks invest capital in maintaining those surfaces.
Hi, Jim. Brian DiDonato, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Kind of on a related topic, there's a lot of talk where, you know, people kind of treat turf and synthetic as sort of interchangeable in a way. Do you find that there's a big difference in terms of bedding handle between the two surfaces?
Yes, we continue to. I think part of it, of course, you know, the most direct link is larger field sizes, but, you know, notwithstanding that we do attract larger fields on the turf, apples to apples, wagers just like betting on turf. There's more angles to it, as we all appreciate. There's turf breeding angles. There's turf jockeys. We can all probably come up to quickly with three or four names that we think are the best turf jockeys that maybe aren't as good on the dirt. And then it just seems to be more strategic in terms of how the horses run the race, or how the jockeys have the horses run the race. And bettors love those angles. And so we definitely continue to see higher wagering on our turf than we do on our Tapeta. And even, as you say, a lot of people draw a close analogy, and that really has to do with the fact that horses move from turf to Tapeta quite well, and vice versa. And that's a big advantage we have, because when we come off the turf, we don't have many scratches. I think our numbers are something like 10% scratches when we go turf to Tapeta. And that's helpful for our business. I won't say we're quicker than other racetracks to move off our turf. We get criticized for it a lot, but we're very protective of our turf course. But we have the advantage that others don't, is when we do move over, it doesn't hurt our business because we don't have many scratches. And so we'd rather run on the turf, though, because the wagering is higher.
Jim, it's Joe again. You were in the news fairly recently talking about the need for single event sports wagering at Woodbine, because I think Canada has a similar system to what America had for a while, which was that you could play parlay cards outside of Vegas, but you couldn't bet on single game, single events. That's changed. We've had other states that have had the advent of single game wagering. Why do you think that that's so important for you guys to get in on the ground floor of, and how close do you think you are, or Canada is, to legalizing it?
Well, let me answer the first one. I think it's extremely important. I spoke at the outset here about the just the competitive environment we're in, and there's no question in the American experience with support. There's no question that the sports wagering is going to cannibalize to some extent horse wagering or par mutual wagering. And so when that happens, and that's part B, I appreciate of the question, when that happens, the racing industry has to be conscious of it. Not only conscious of it, but we have to push very hard to participate in it. And that's why I'm at this time being so outspoken that there are so many thousands of jobs and tens of thousands of jobs represented by the horse industry. As we all know, it's a very labor-intensive industry that we have to appeal to government, not only in the number of jobs it creates and maintains, but also the economic impact that horse racing has on the economy. And so it's going to be important that we have it. I think that once sports wagering comes, it also opens up the doors, as you're about to experience in the United States, to fixed odds wagering on horse racing, which already occurs, of course, in the gray market. And if there is fixed odds wagering on horse racing, and the racing industry is not part of that, then we've all got a big problem, and it will very much cannibalize the product. I think you've seen experience in Australia is that on win place and show wagering, they have moved to as much as 50 or 60% of fixed odds wagering on horse racing. And so the industry has to stand up and say, listen, if you're going to open this up, including opening it up to wagering on horse racing, we need to participate, or you are going to cause tens of thousands of jobs, at least in Ontario alone. And the economic impact is in the billions that needs to be protected. Secondly, as you asked, I think that the time has come for sports wagering in Canada, single game sports wagering. We do have parlay wagering, and the revenue miss from a government standpoint is huge, and the numbers are such that the government can't overlook it anymore. We can't get into politics, but we have extensive social medical costs in Canada and education costs, and the burden of carrying those, as there is an aging demographic in Canada, like the United States, we're with the baby boomers needing more medical care, and there being social medical care in Canada. The government, of course, is feeling the pressure, and this is an obvious revenue source with most of it going offshore today. And I think there's been an acknowledgement of that. in many circles, and I won't be surprised if you see Canada moving to single event sports wagering in the near term.
Got it. I just wanted to ask a quick follow-up. You know, there is going to be more revenue if and when single event sports wagering becomes legal. My question, because we rarely have the people who make the decisions at these tracks on our show, so I wanted to ask, you know, Parks got in a little bit of trouble recently where they had their slot subsidies taken away, and for years and years and years they had these juiced up purses, but the bettors really didn't see any benefits of that. They didn't cut takeout or anything. So my question to you is, you guys do have pretty competitive takeout rates at your track, but I would say the pick four or the pick five is probably a little higher than I would like to see. If you do get increased funding from sports betting, would you be open to cutting takeout as well?
Well, it's a much longer analysis than that. I'm not at all being evasive of this. I think one of the distinctions, and Woodbine comes under the microscope regularly, one of the distinctions that we have is that we're operating in a different country with different tax rates. And, you know, one of the things to think about right off the bat is there's no tax on wagering in Canada at any level. So the government taxes the racetracks and in effect takes away from the takeout rates, because within our pari mutuel taxes that we pay right off the top on wagering, that comes out before, whereas a number of U.S. tracks and U.S. citizens are taxed after the fact. So if there's a large win at a number of tracks, there are taxes after the fact. So that's one distinction. In addition to that, as we just live in a different tax environment. So if you went percentage by percentage out of our pari mutuel taxes, we pay for things in terms of horse care, aftercare alliance, and other items that don't appear in U.S. tracks. So then, without getting into the details, our rates, our simulcast rates, are much different than the leverage, I'll say, that some of the larger groups have at Monarch and Naira and Churchill and Keeneland. So we have, you know, in terms of those agreements that we have, Woodbine, while we like to consider ourselves a Class A track, we have higher rates in terms of our relationships. So there are a number of factors. In answer to your question, I think it is, we're always looking to do best for our customer and stay competitive. If we had sports wagering, it's the reason I say it's a much longer question is because fixed odds wagering, as you might appreciate, may need a whole revamping of the system, because what happens then is you have fixed odds wagering, which is by its very nature competing with other sports betting, and the margins are very low on that. And that's one thing that the horse racing community has to understand is it may feel like, wow, wouldn't this be great to have fixed odds wagering? We're going to attract all these new wagers, but the margins will be very thin. And so we're going to have to sit down with our government, and governments don't always understand this very well, that we're going to have to potentially look at revamping our pari mutuel structure in order to be competitive, in order that the two types of wagering, fixed odds and under sports wagering, are competitive with pari mutuel wagering. And right now, the fixed odds wagering is very thin margins, and so we're going to have to be very careful as racetracks that if the world moves to fixed odds wagering, we're going to have to figure out what those tax structures look like. So I don't know that it's an easy answer, because the world, if it moves to sports wagering, is not at an environment because that has a lot of margin, because most of the companies that are, you can think of the brand names, whether it be Bet365 or Bodog or FanDuel, and the list goes on, they don't have the overhead that the racetracks have. They have, we at Woodbine, to run 133 days of racing in our standard bred racing, we have approximately $100 million of operating costs a year. And that excludes any purses that we pay out. And when you've got $100 million operating nut and your competition, which are those betting places, are operating offshore without any overhead, that's where you get into issues in terms of margins, in terms of the cost of goods sold here. It gets very expensive for the racetracks. And this is all, so it's very hard to say, wow, if you've got sports betting money, would you reduce your takeout rates? It's much more complicated than that in terms of what it looks like. We would hope that if we got sports betting, sports wagering, that we could find a way to make it work, because it's not an obviously profitable venture for the tracks. What it is it does attract a whole new generation of customers and a whole new way of looking at wagering on horses, which I think will be helpful.
Hey, Jim, it's Bill Finley again. Towards the tail end of the meet in 2019, you guys made a lot of headlines with a new rules on whipping. It was the most restrictive rules, I think, for any racetrack in North America. By all accounts, it was a success. Handle did not go down. There were no incidents that I know of among the jockeys or having trouble controlling the horses. So for 2020, we want to know, is this going to be the new way of doing things at Woodbine? I know the final decision is made by the Alcohol and Gaming Commission, but I would imagine they would probably do what you guys want them to do. So what about whipping at Woodbine in 2020?
Well, I'm smiling, Bill, only because I heard you say that the Alcohol and Gaming Commission of Ontario will do what we want them to do. I wish that was true. But yes, I think that we've been cooperating with them. We have a good relationship with them, and they're respectful of our expertise in that area. And I'll also mentioned category one versus category two. I don't know whether you're planning on asking me about that, but on the whipping rules, I have every reason to believe, I don't think it's been officially announced by the ADCO, but I have every reason to believe we were going to leave the urging rules status quo as we ended last year. I think it was a successful experiment. We didn't have big issues. I think as everyone appreciates, it was in large part a reaction to the public perception. But and maybe more importantly, I think it's better for the horses. I think I think there's no question that using different types of whips, and that's part of it, and not allowing that overhand whaling on a horse, as we've seen historically, is just better all the way around. And you know, it wasn't trouble-free in the sense that the jockeys didn't like it, and a number of them still won't like it, but they've learned to adapt. But we did not have a lot of problems. We did not have a lot of complaints from our customers about it. And all in all, we would regard it as a successful experiment. And as you may have read, that maybe you, Bill, that I talked to about it, we did not experience any depreciation or any diminishment in our wagering. In fact, on a per race basis, our wagering went up during the 6-week period that we experimented with the urging rules. Once again, in terms of Woodbine trying to lead the way, we're of the view, and we're not being shy about it, that we'd like to see North America move to Category 1 interference rules. We could argue either way. I can argue either way. But all in all, in terms of our wagering customers like it better, we think it's a better rule. We think it makes more sense. And we're hoping that we'll see Canada at least, certainly Ontario, moved to Category 1 interference rules. We don't think it's going to be an issue with horsemen coming up from the United States and being faced with Category 1 interference rules instead of Category 2, and we'll see where it goes. I think the AGCO has completed a survey, and I think before the season starts, they're going to make a decision, and we're hoping that they move to Category 1. We're just seeing a larger amount of our business out of Asia and out of Australia, and the experiments with it, particularly the last 2 years, France Galop has just come up with numbers in France, and their wagers are happy with it. They've had, they had a handful of complaints last year about Category 1 interference rules from their wagering customers, and that's way down from what it was previously under Category 2. So that's just another example of we're trying to do things differently and lead the way. And I think if we lead the way on that, other U.S. jurisdictions may follow. So we'll see.
Gotcha. We definitely appreciate you guys trying new things, and we wish that more tracks would follow your lead. So we appreciate the time, Jim. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with this year's meet.
Nice talking to you guys, and let us know when you're up. We'd love to see you come up.
Gotcha.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
All the best.
Bye. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As The Green Group Guest of the Week, Jim Lawson will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. The Green Group, bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. So that's going to do it for this week's episode of the TDN Writers Room, sponsored by Keeneland, the home of world-class racing and industry-leading sales. Keeneland's next auction is the April 2-Year-Olds in Training and Horses of Racing Age sale on Tuesday, April 7th. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Brian DiDonato, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Jim Lawson, also our producer, Patty Wolf, and our editor, Nathan Wilkinson. We will see you next week.